and welcome to another Comics Burst from the Full Force podcast, sponsored by Distant Planet Comics and Collectibles, where we take an in-depth look at the newest G.I. Joe comics and related titles of the week. I am Chris McLeod, aka Diagnostic 80, and joining me on this burst tonight are the Lucky Charmers themselves, Paddy Oibigora Lennon and Brian Eyeshot Shergar Hickey. So let's get into our first comic for this week.
Oh,
and I should say, spoilers ahead. First up, Transformers vs. the Visionaries number 4. Leoric and Ironhide only have hours left to save Cybertron from destruction, while Virilina tries to harness the life energy of Leoric's captured friends to accelerate the end. Now Leoric must somehow detonate the counterwave bomb and rescue his people, and the clock is ticking. So this one, as Paddy and I spoke about on the last Comics Burst, or the overall kind of arc so far, was one that we were both quite impressed with. We thought it started very strong. Obviously, there was the, you know, spoiler, there was the death of Cup, which was like a big, big deal that I kept saying Ironhide and had to edit it out last time. and in this issue, so they've gone through the whole Darkling Lords versus Spectral Knights battle. They've gone, you know, so we've seen the Visionaries kind of in, as in their original kind of active selves, as they were in the originals. We've seen character development in a few different areas. Now, I mentioned on the last episode, and Paddy will back me up on this, that I was really happy that they kept Mortrid as the kind of, you know, right-hand man type scenario. And in actual fact, what it turns out to be at the beginning of this issue is that he's in fact been captured and is being tortured along with Witterquick. So it's not as I expected, and Mortrid is actually Virilina's kind of like spy right-hand man. In actual fact, he was all along going along with the Spectral Knights, or so we are led to believe here.
Or so we think.
Yes, because Mortrid isn't exactly being... is not, you don't see him being tortured. That's another thing that I should probably mention. So
is that not Mortrid getting tortured?
He's up there, but he's not actually being electrocuted, is he? It's Witterquick that's getting the electrocution.
The short end of the stick, yeah.
Or the long end of a massive weapon. But so that's something that might still be up in the air, but he is still talking to Recon, and Recon is responding to him as if Mortrid is just out for himself, which would lend to the fact that he is more like Lexor originally than, like I said before. Again, it's getting a little complicated, but effectively at the beginning of this, Mortrid and Witterquick are being, you know, tortured. Now, before we get into the details, like I've just started doing, Brian, you're first on the... this is your first Comics Burst. What's your overall take been on the overall Visionary, Transformers Visionaries arc so far, but then also this comic?
I've been loving this run. I think this is fantastic piece of work from Fizzaggio, Alcio, and Cruz. And I just want to comment, the cover artwork on this is beautiful. If anyone hasn't picked these up yet, or if you're not familiar with them, the artwork on the cover of these comics is phenomenal.
Yeah, next level.
And you notice that the cover is a slightly different weight from, say, your typical comics from IDW.
Yeah,
it's kind
yeah.
of a heavier weight to it. I really like that. It makes it feel very...
A little bit more premium
for sure, and you know, I think from an art point of view and from a writing point of view, I think this is one of the best things that IDW have at the minute. The first three episodes, obviously, I was gutted when Cup got taken out, and like that, I thought it was going to be Ironhide when you see the cover, because Ironhide is on the front cover. He's, you know, Virilina has taken him out, but I was gutted when it was Cup, and I didn't believe. I said, he'll come back. You know, in issue two, we'll be back. And of course, you see them marching around with his head at that stage, and you realize he ain't coming back. Look at that, you know, kind of the last episode there. I really thought Mortrid was playing the Spectral Knights, that he was, you know, like a double agent.
Yeah.
Looking at the first few pages of this comic, I'm starting to think, no, maybe the guy is just really dense and is, you know, he's in big trouble now. I haven't read all of this yet, so I've only got through the first couple of pages on it, so I can't say much more than that. But overall, I love how this series has kind of spun out of the Revolutionaries series, and really, really enjoying it, and highly recommend it to anybody who hasn't got on board with this yet.
I totally agree. It's the covers are definitely that heavier stock. In fact, the first issue when it came out had this beautiful embossed kind of like almost like the elements that weren't white were kind of raised, and it made this really nice effect, and it was just, yeah, really gorgeous cover.
Yeah, like a spot UV, that's what that's called. It's a spot UV in the first one, and it's kind of a matte finish underneath that, which is, you know, beautifully done.
Yeah, absolutely. Paduardo, take us through your thoughts on this most recent issue.
One slight disappointment I had at the start of this issue was, last issue, as you know, we had a cliffhanger with Virilina riding Waspinator like a vehicle.
Yeah.
And I thought we were going to see her use that to knock the shit out of Witherquick and Mordred, but we didn't see that.
Yeah.
So, you know, you give us this big cliffhanger and then you don't pay it off. Which I kind of thought was, all you needed was a page or a few panels.
Agreed.
Of them getting knocked around, you know? It's kind of weird that they leave it on a cliffhanger and then don't show you how to cliffhanger.
It's almost as if they were just thinking it was so overpowered, we just have to give up at this stage. You know, like, Witherquick was obviously in the pincers of Waspinator, and Mordred was by the side of Virilina up on the actual on Waspinator, which is why I thought he was kind of like, you know, a right hand man. And
even though
Witherquick is knocked out, Mordred, this is my kind of like thought process of still thinking Mordred is a plant. We don't see him actually getting tortured. We just see him hanging up there with Witherquick.
Mm-hmm.
When you see Witherquick, he is knocked out at the end panel, like he's hanging from Waspinator, like completely unawares. So he may not be aware that Mordred is with the Darkling Lords, right next to Virilina. Arzon is aware of that, but he's not being tortured. He's separate from Witherquick. So that's why I'm thinking I'm still clinging to the hope that Mordred is a spy. And that they just keep using him to get information out of, you know, Witherquick or whoever is in the situation.
Just to throw in there, right? I'm looking at that last panel of issue 3 of the Transformers versus Visionaries, and Mordred is looking pretty cash, sitting up there behind Virilina on the top of Waspinator. He ain't looking like a guy who just got caught by his boss for double-crossing him. He's looking pretty smug.
Yes,
when you see that last panel.
I see what you're saying. Yeah, absolutely. I agree with that. Yeah. So, I think that it might be like an underlying little story that we'll see pan out. But when I first saw that page, I was kind of like, I almost brought myself back and thought, oh, he's not a spy. But then, obviously, there are subtle things in there. Like you say, at the end of that issue, at the beginning of this one, there are subtle things in there that may suggest he is still on Virilina's side. So,
there's only one issue left, right? It's 5 issues?
Yeah, I think it's 5 issues, yeah.
Yeah, there's a lot to wrap up in those 20 pages. I have a feeling that the ending is going to be very, very rushed because, like, we don't have a whole lot of time for them to wrap up what's going to happen with the Autobots at the center of Cybertron, and for Lyric is presumably going to, you know, attack Virilina again to figure out what's going to happen with Mordred and Cryotech. I think that's a lot for one issue. I have a feeling that there's probably a little bit too much going on for a 5-issue series, if anything.
Yeah, I mean that is a bit of a shame to, you know, like you say, like you get to the point where maybe the end is coming sooner than you thought it was coming. And I think, like, the end of this issue, so to get a bit of a spoiler alert, again, throwing in the spoilers out there, Quick Switch is used because of his drill function to drill into the core of Cybertron to try and set off a bomb that Wheeljack has created. I say a bomb. There's a lot of explanation as to what it actually does.
It's essentially an EMP burst. Yeah. That will counteract the Darkling Lords' infection of Cybertron.
Thank you very much, Paddy. And obviously, it's attached to him, so they all get inside Quick Switch, and he drills down. He actually dies from getting too close to the core, and the other guys kind of get out of him. They retrieve the EMP/bomb, and at the same time, in a running storyline, Arzon has been talking with Virilina this whole time. She's also been kicking Cryotech's but we'll come to that a bit later on. And in that conversation, she basically talks Arzon into becoming a Darkling Lord, to following their extermination of Cybertron, effectively. And he turns up with Kravex, and hang on, I'll just...
That's the other problem with this, is they haven't had enough time with any of the characters, so they're beginning to slowly fuse into one.
Oh, it's Sindar. It's Sindar, isn't it?
For someone who's only got a passing familiarity with the Visionaries characters, it's very confusing to keep track of who's who, because there's nothing, they're all wearing similar colours. They're all wearing a mixture of blue and red, the Darkling Lords, and, you know, former Spectral Knights.
Usually they put a little name tag next to the person who it is, which does help. And yeah. I think it's Sindar. I'm just going to go out and say it's Sindar for now. I will double check that, and obviously we can make a note if it isn't. But effectively, three of the Darkling Lords turn up, with Arzon kind of in charge of them. Kravex is definitely the other one. I love that mask. And basically chops the bomb in half.
And they're all in slightly different outfits to how you've seen them previously. They're all armoured up.
Yes,
With helmets and stuff, and you've never seen them in their helmets before. So it is. I found it very tough to kind of figure out, wait, who is this now?
Yeah.
I figured one of them was Arzon, but the other ones I was like, I don't know who those two guys in the background are.
Well, the only reason you knew it was Arzon is because they shout, Arzon, it's you.
And
he's
exactly.
He's got the feathers and stuff like that. But like, it was more so Kravix, I recognise the helmet. With the other guy, it's going to be a case of going back to those, that pre-production art and the IDW with throwing up in their panel at HasCon, because that's probably the only way I'll work it out. I think it is Sindar, though. But anyway, they turn up and Arzon cuts the bomb in half, and that's the final panel. In the meantime, we've also seen Cryotech having a bit of an argy-bargy, because he burst in on Recon, who was torturing Witterquick and Mortrid. I do that in the air quotes. And like had a little bit of kind of an argument with him. Virilina turns up and she's a bit worried about Crytek's. Is he a Darkling Lord? Is he not? So they have a bit of a fight. And Crytek, it would appear, is now kind of on the is switched back to the Spectral Knights. He contacts Leoric and tips them off at what's going on with Witterquick. So and Arzon. So now we're in this position, like Paddy said, where we've got to wrap up a lot of different things. How do you think it's going to be done? Do you think double size issue? And what do you think needs to be wrapped up?
Well, it hasn't been solicited as a double size issue. So, you know, it's not. because they would say that in previews, and they haven't.
Sure.
It's kind of a big deal. I do think we will end up with Leoric defeating Virilina. We've already seen kind of a premonition of that in this issue, with her essentially being dead on the floor.
Yeah.
I imagine another Transformer is going to sacrifice themselves to set off that bomb.
I reckon Ironhide will do it.
Yeah, one or the other of him or Wheeljack. And I think that would be, I think that's all they're going to really have time to settle up.
Yeah.
I think a lot of it is just going to be left kind of hanging there for a sequel series that may or may not come.
That's something we'll come to a little later on as well.
I am very disappointed that Six Knight, or Quick Switch as he's called over here, gets introduced and killed off with very little love shown to the character, because I actually quite like that character. So I'm a little bit sad.
It's always difficult when dealing with the kind of deaths in these things, because with the Transformers, I feel like they always have like a decent character background, even if they just were a toy in like the G2 line or something. There's always there's something there. There's always substance to that character. Because of the way the toys were marketed and the way, you know, you had the bios and all that kind of stuff. And then even then, you have TF Wiki, which just pumps information to that site so much and so often and so quickly that you almost feel for every single character that comes out. And obviously the way the Transformers comics have been over the last few years, the characterization has been top notch, hasn't it? I mean, the way they've developed characters in this IDW continuity. And again, we'll come to that a bit later on, but it's exceptional. So yeah, I can understand that, Paddy. I can see that being sad. And they do a little bit gloss over, like, oh, that's a shame that Quick Switch is dead. Okay, let's sort this bomb out. You know, it's
yeah.
I know they have to, but you know, that always worries, it always upsets me they don't give them enough love.
I have a feeling it may have been better if they'd had him in from the start.
Yeah.
Like, as it had him in as, you know, one of Wheeljack's assistants, or even just one of Ironhide's team, since Quick Switch is, you know, a quite a powerful Transformers character.
Yars.
If he'd been one of the security force with Ironhide from the start, and was given a little bit more, like, this is the introduction issue of him to IDW continuity, and he's dead 15 pages into it.
Yeah.
It would have been a bit nicer if they'd given him a little bit more time in the series. That's all.
What we have found out as well in talking to a lot of the comic book writers is a lot of these things, when it's like a Hasbro property, is determined by Hasbro, or at the very least signed off on. So I would imagine that Hasbro said, okay, if you want a character for this particular purpose, then this is the one we want you to do it with, or, you know, this is what we want, you know. So I can see that being a little bit out of the comic writer's hands. But again, totally agree with you, Paddy. It was a shame, and I actually liked him just in that tiny little element that he had. Like, I've kind of felt like, oh, this is a character I really enjoy. But anyway, let's give Transformers versus Visionaries issue 4 a potato rating, or a potating, as I'm calling it from now on. First, Brian, out of 5, how many taters do you give this one?
Well, because I'm such a big fan of the artwork in this, I really enjoy the writing as well. And although I haven't finished this issue, just from skimming over it and looking at the all-out action, like, they've really ramped up the action for this issue 4, I'm going in with a full 5 potatoes.
You're going 5? I knew Brian would go full 5 potatoes. Paddy, how many potatoes?
I actually think this is probably less effective than the issues that came before it. I do think there is a little bit of a rush to the end happening now.
Yeah.
And I think this is probably one of the weaker issues of the series so far. So I'm going to give it 2 potatoes.
2 potatoes. This is why we have the yin and yang on, the Irish yin and yang. I'm going to go for kind of an in the middle-y job here, and I'm going to go for 3.5 taters. Because for one thing, there's parts that I do agree with Paddy on there. But in terms of like a small run, if you're doing like a 5-issue series, there still needs to be a certain element of character development, right? But at the same time, I still think each issue needs to be a stonker. I still thought there were good things in this. I thought the kind of switching of Arzon was pretty cool. I thought the ending of him cutting the bomb in half was pretty cool, and I thought the shock factor of Quick Switch dying was pretty like powerful. So again, I think there was some good things in this, some interesting thing. Again, the art is always on point. The writing is still really good. I'm still enjoying it. I'm still in that mode where I'll read this comic and get drawn completely in. Like, there won't be a thing where things distract me or I'll start thinking of something else, which is, I know, that's when I know a comic is not good for me, is when I start, you know, all over the place. And with this one, I'm always drawn in. So it's still doing good things. I do agree with Paddy. I don't think it's the best of the series so far. I think we're in for a pretty explosive 5th issue, and we'll see very soon. So moving on. G.I. Joe, a real American hero, versus the $6 million man, issue 2. Longest title in comics at the moment. Stranded in a snake pit, on a cobra-sieged island, Hawk and his G.I. Joes must protect the world's most powerful leaders of peace from a renegade $6 million man. While Snake Eyes and Scarlet begin their impossible ascent up the planet's deadliest structure, with Cobra Commander waiting at the top. More bonkers awesomeness with this one for me. I'm just going to go ahead first because I think it's been absolutely brilliant, this comic. Again, as Paddy mentioned last week, it doesn't take itself seriously in the slightest. And I think that's where it succeeds. You know, things like the fact that halfway through, Hawk has to create a diversion and decides to fist fight the $6 million man. I mean, I know it creates a diversion, but at the same time, Cobra, they're so ridiculous. They're always like, oh, we must savor the deaths. We can't just exterminate them. We must savor the deaths. It's just so beautifully 80s. It's so beautifully 80s supervillain. You know, telling the good guys their plan giving them enough information for them to hang themselves with, you know, like, it's just genius. So I think this one for me has just been great, and what an awesome surprise at the end. But I'm not going to spoil it just yet. I want to hear from you guys. So Paddy, what were your thoughts on the $6 million man?
Yeah, I'd agree with everything you said. It's a strong follow-up to the first issue. Again, it just remains being a fun comic. It doesn't take itself seriously, has fun with the characters, gives everybody a little bit of a moment. I'm quite happy with it. I think it's a very good comic.
Awesome. And Brian?
This series is great fun. I haven't fully finished issue 2. I've read all of the next comic we're going to talk about. But issue 1, absolutely loved it. And what I love about obviously big fan of S.L. Gallant's art. You know, we're all familiar with his work on the Real American Hero line. But I noticed when I was reading through issue one, he's got these very subtle nods back to the 70s in the style and the dress of the civilian characters. And in one panel, you even see like a billboard with, you know, Sean Connery, Time Bandits.
Do you know what? I don't think I noticed that. I'm going to have to read through that again. I did not notice that the first time round.
And look at the style of the civilian characters. So they vary without kind of saying, and you know, putting a date on this, they've placed it in a historically, it's it could be part of the current Real American Hero universe, but obviously at a much earlier time frame. And because it's S.L. Gallant's art, it feels, visually, it feels like it's part of the same universe. I love that. I mean, it's, you know, you see Steve Austin there at the end of issue one. He's coming in, he takes out the Joes. Like, you know, it's like it's nothing to him. It's so easy. And you see him in the last panel, he's like, Cobra! And, you know, we look at kind of the opening scenes and this one, he just wants to go in and finish the job, get it done. And as you say, Baroness pulls him back and, you know, we got to relish the hunt and savor the kill.
Exactly.
And you know, that's famous last words. You know, that's going to be their downfall.
It's funny you should say that you haven't got to the end of this one again, Brian, because I'm about to spoil something massive for you again. In the last panel of this one, okay, so from the beginning, there's a conversation between Mainframe, obviously the Steve Austin's handler, and the government, and they're trying to work out what the best course of action is. The government obviously want to, you know, as always in every single 80s or in every single film ever, all they want to do is nuke the problem away. That's all they ever want to do. They just want to obliterate everything in order to save everything. It's the most illogical response to anything I've ever known in my life, but they use it every single time. But in this, they're using that trope as like a, this is exactly what you expect to happen, so we're going to go with it. And then, you know, Mainframe saying, well, let's implement this this special power play, which I think, protocol power play, they call it. The government are all like, what? Oh no, we can't do that, it's too early in the game for that. And, you know, everyone's kind of like, well, okay, we'll try it. You've got 24 hours. So then the next thing you see in the last panel, Mainframe and the handler, Steve Austin's handler, they fly out to this island, kind of beautiful kind of location, palm trees and so on and so forth. And sitting there, who is Protocol Power Play, is Mike Power, the Atomic Man. So he stands up and he's got, you know, he's got what I thought initially. I glanced at the panel and thought, why is Chuckles the Protocol Power Play? I was like, what's Chuckles got to do with it? And it's not. It's just Mike Power wearing a Hawaiian shirt and some pretty sweet shorts. But again, it's like a really, really cool reveal. It's something that you kind of, I suppose, should have expected, you know, kind of in that era. And boom, there you go. And I can't wait to see what he's going to, you know, how he's going to be kind of used in this. And also, Paddy, you talk about like rushing to an end in certain small runs. $6 Million Man seems to be getting some momentum, and we're only in issue two, so like I feel like there's more, they'll probably have a little bit more to work with when it comes to the end of this comic.
I think so. It just is, I'm gonna say it, I think it's probably just, it's a better writer, or they're not trying to do as much. I mean, Visionaries, they're trying to re-establish them as a franchise for the next 10 years and also tell a story and also cross it over with Transformers. Whereas with this, I think the writer has just been told, you know, have the $6 million man fight G.I. Joe.
He doesn't
have to do as much with this, you know, this, the $6 million versus G.I. Joe isn't going to be a forthcoming franchise requiring a $100 million movie.
Or $6 million movie, man.
Or whatever, yeah. So
they should release it as like an almost like a comedy where he's a $6 million man in a world where $6 million is all now. That's what should happen.
I'm actually just thinking this would actually be a very good base, like a story like this is what a G.I. Joe movie should probably be.
Yeah,
you know, that way where they put a little bit of fun into it, you don't have to think about too much. It's not a dour, grim, dark, oh my god, the entire team is dead.
Yeah.
Movie. You should just, you know, just do a fun, enjoyable romp. And I think it would be a much better. This is probably the blueprint for a better G.I. Joe movie than the two we've had already.
There are numerous blueprints that are better than what we've had in terms of films.
You know what I mean? The tone of this, where they're wearing the 1980s costumes and there's a little bit of I could see this being like, if you played this as a comedy and used it as the basis of a G.I. Joe movie, it would probably be a pretty decent G.I. Joe movie.
Absolutely. I totally agree with that.
You know, got the right cast, got the right directors in it. And it's not parodying the material, but it does have a knowing wink to it. Like it knows that some of the ideas they're playing with are kind of stupid.
Yeah.
But they're having fun with them. And I think it's a nice change of pace for when we've had, you know, so many years of everybody in G.I. Joe being a borderline psychopath. It's nice. You know, it's nice that someone's decided, you know, we're just going to have a bit of fun with the franchise.
Yeah. No, I agree with that totally. Totally. And with that said, actually, before we get into the potatings, I would like to mention how much I bloody love that cover with Snake Eyes and the reflection of Steve Austin in his sword. I just love that so much. It's one of my favorite covers, I think, so far of all. I mean, you get like 50 retailer incentive covers now, so I think that's one of my favorites. Okay, moving on to potatings. What would you give G.I. Joe vs. the $6 Million Man, Brian Hickey?
I haven't finished this one yet, but I'm going to go comfortably with a 4 potating. And I skipped to the back there and I saw the Mike Power Atomic Man reveal. I love that he's got his very expensive bottle of tequila with him.
Yeah.
And just looks so annoyed that he has to go and do some work now.
Brilliant. I love how like Mike Power Atomic Man is like some sort of, like, I don't know, like Lethal Weapon Mel Gibson type, you know, the kind of guy living on a beach somewhere, like just drinking himself to death. Like that is
actually there is a big feeling of kind of a late 1980s action comedy coming off the series.
Yeah, and do you know what? Just dawned on me. It has that Tom Selleck in Magnum PI vibe, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
With the shirt, living on the, you know, on the coast and everything. Yeah, that's hilarious.
Well, for that, I'm going 4.5 potatoes now for that.
4.5. He's gone up. He's increased it. In fact, Brian, you should just operate in the Justin Bell rating system with 5 for everything. What about you, Paduardo Lenweenan?
I will go for 4 potatoes.
He's gone for a 4, just because he doesn't want to be as much as Brian. Paddy has gone for a rebellious 4 potato rating, and I will just go full on 5 beans because this is just amazing. I love every second of reading this, and I quite like the fact they've brought it back from, you know, it's almost like a continuation of The Real American Hero in the fact that of the visual style, as you said, Brian, but obviously going back to a period piece in the early 80s. Now, loving that, let's move on to probably one of the biggest comic releases for G.I. Joe in its history, you could say. Let's move on. That was a big claim, wasn't it? G.I. Joe, A Real American Hero, number 250. Dawn of the Arashikagi, part 5. Here it is, the conclusion to the latest explosive chapter in G.I. Joe, A Real American Hero lore. Dawn Moreno has battled the dangerous enemies and her own inner demons as the ghost of Snake Eyes threatens to possess her mind and soul. Will she survive the psychic onslaught or be lost to the dark memories of the mysterious ninja for all time? Find out in this special oversized milestone issue. Now, this was a doozy. Like, there's a lot to be said here. Let's just first off go straight into Paddy Lennon. What did you make of this issue as the 250 and the final of this particular arc?
Didn't read it. Didn't read the previous 100 issues. Do not give a f***.
Awesome.
Paddy.
So, well, that's Paddy's input. Let's go to Brian. What did you think of this one, Brian?
This comic I've read. And I will just say, get the bleeper ready. F*** me. This is amazing. Okay, I need to roll back a little bit here. I was following The Real American Hero for quite a while, a number of years back. I jumped out. And when I started to see images of Dawn Moreno pop up on Facebook on the various kind of friends feeds or kind of Joe-related feeds, I thought, this character looks interesting. So it got me back in. Dawn Moreno got me back into The Real American Hero. And I jumped back in at issue 244, I think it was.
Yeah.
244, yeah. That's what got back in at that point. And immediately got engrossed back in The Real American Hero universe.
Mm.
I think Netho Diaz's art, and I appreciate he's, you know, only working on this now for a short while. We'd be expecting SL Gallant to come back to Real American Hero, but Neto Diaz's art, I think, is amazing. I think he's an incredible artist. And I love his work on this. Looking at, we had kind of our homage to the Silent issue by issue 248.
Yeah.
That was phenomenal. I was halfway through that comic before I realized it was a Silent issue. That's how engrossed I was in the visual storytelling.
Yeah.
It was unbelievable. Just got sucked right into it. In 249, I thought there was too much banter between Dawn and Firefly. I was like, come on, you've got a chance to kill this guy. Just kill him and get on with it.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think they roll back on that a little bit on this final issue. So the confrontation between Firefly and Dawn is, I think it's a much, you know, it's handled a lot better. There's a lot less kind of chat or, you know, banter. But where there is banter, it's kind of, it works with the action between the two characters.
Yeah.
It works quite well. I was on the edge of my seat reading this. I really was on the edge of my seat. And the reveal that Budo wasn't actually Budo just totally took me by surprise.
Yeah.
And obviously that has to be, you know, resolved, you know, beyond this issue. And we could be waiting a while before it comes back to that.
Yeah, so let me just jump in there where you talk about the Budo thing, because I have mixed feelings about this issue. For one thing, obviously it's a double-sized issue, so there's way more value to this one. You know, you've got like loads going on in it, loads of opportunity to really delve into this story, and it's fast-paced, it's full of action. You're still seeing, you know, you obviously the team turn up on the scene, Budo, Storm Shadow, Stalker, Sean Snake Eyes, Sean Eyes I'm gonna call him, and Scarlet, they turn up on the scene just as Dawn is chasing Firefly onto the train tracks. And then you end up in this position where they're on top of this train, much like, you know, way back in previous Serial American Hero issues, back in the original Marvel run. And we do get flashbacks as well in it to kind of like almost explain what's going on in between everyone's kind of thought process and everything. Dawn and Firefly kind of face to face. Firefly, you know, basically Dawn as Snake Eyes is wanting revenge on Firefly. And by the end of the kind of chase on the train, the helicopter turns up that's been, you know, in close pursuit, and out pops Scarlet, and who you think is Budo, jumping out of the helicopter. And as they land, turns into the Softmaster. And out of nowhere, you kind of think, what? And then all of a sudden it kind of makes sense when Scarlet's like, it's Zartan. And you're like, oh, I see. So Zartan then was Budo the whole time. And that's why you're not seeing any dialogue from him in the previous issues, which it kind of dawned on me as I'm reading it. I'm kind of like, oh, of course, like it was things that they were pointing to him, say he's got a job to do. He'll know what to do when it happens. He's going to, you know, so they're kind of pointing at him making a point of this guy is important. And you think Budo is going to do something really cool, and it turns out to be Zartan. So I think I was so G'd up to see Budo because I'm a big, big fan of the Fringe characters. You know, I get to the point when I've seen the same characters over and over again that I tend to just kind of go, you know, yawn a little bit. Yawn Moreno. I'm just kidding. But I really like the fact, you know, obviously Firefly isn't someone that's in it all the time. He's in it a lot. I mean, he's had a good, solid, substantial run in these comics, but so we're nowhere near the amount of times that we've seen Duke, Baroness, Destro, Cobra Commander. Fair enough, they're the main core characters, but I do love seeing Fringe characters, and I like, you know, the thought of Budo being involved. I was like, oh, this is going to be amazing. When he turned out to be Zartan, I was a little bit like, oh, okay, you know, fair enough. You know, that's just how it has to be. And we, you know, we don't really see Budo as a character. We just see him as a visual thing. And again, I kind of think it was a little bit of a, I don't know, a little bit of a farty ending for me. Also, like the fact that they're on the train and it's just a little bit kind of like, you know, I'm not going to seek revenge anymore. I'm calm. I'm not going to take over Dawn's memory. So there's two of us acting in the same body now. It's not going to be a thing where Snake Eyes takes over her mind. That was a little bit too easy to wrap up. And then the whole thing of the Softmaster, Zartan, jumping on Firefly and then just jumping into the water as if to say, well, you know, we don't know what's going to happen with those two. You know, we don't know what the situation is, but you can probably count on the fact that both of those characters will appear later on down the line. Yeah, I was happy with how it was proceeding, But then when that happened at the end, I was a little bit like the wind was knocked out of me a little bit. So I think overall, a solid issue. Great art, as always, as you mentioned. Fantastic storytelling up until that point for me. And I just, you know, really enjoyed it. But then that ending really kind of kicked me in the nuts. So I kind of think, for me as a fringe character enjoyer, I don't know if that's a thing, you know, it just didn't tickle my fancy as a complete piece. But overall, really solid. Now, the comic will switch into special mission style for 5 issues, and they're focusing on, this is another thing that's upset me and I want to talk about it, and they're focusing on Duke, Baroness, Destro, Stalker is going to be the first one, and one other that hasn't been announced yet. I'm a bit annoyed that we're just seeing effectively one-shot character issues. Don't call it special missions. Call it Spotlight, like they did with the Transformers. G.I. Joe Spotlight would be great, you know. So I think that doing it special missions really does annoy me, because I want to see special missions, but I want to see fringe special teams doing what they do best with possibly different squad leaders. So you could squeeze in like a Night Force issue and have Falcon leading the team, or you could squeeze in a Tiger Force issue and have Duke, you can have Flint leading the squad, or someone else that's in that group that could be just something a little bit different. And instead, we kind of get the same old, same old. What do you guys think about that?
I think, there's a few things there. I mean, if these special missions are going to be kind of standalone and aren't going to kind of weave back into the continuity that we've been following, because, you know, where the continuity dropped off after issue 244. Or 245, and it focused entirely on Don Moreno. There's a lot of things that they left open there that haven't been kind of wrapped up yet, and I'm really looking for those storylines to come back into the real American Hero continuity. So if the special missions are kind of standalone adventures, if they don't weave back into that continuity somehow, that's a big wait. So we're going to be waiting 5 months before we can, yeah, you know, pick up what happens, you know, with, say, you know, Dr. Venom, and obviously where we left off with, I think it's Bombstrike, or
yeah,
the guys who, you know, got into the Black Majors
Bombstrike, Red Shadows, all of that stuff. Yeah, yeah.
So there's a lot happening there that I really want to see what's going to come out of that. So I wouldn't fancy you having to wait 5 months and have these kind of just, you know, one-offs that have nothing to do with the rest of the storyline that, yeah, we've been following.
Well, it looks like Stalk is going to be kind of almost like a flashback thing where he's dealing with demons of the past. So that's one that you can definitely probably say is going to have nothing to do with moving the story further along for the actual story arc. It'll just be more character development for Stalker. We don't know, obviously, what Duke and Baroness is going to be like specifically, but again, and then obviously Destro was revealed with the John Royal art that he's doing for that issue. It's either a Destro issue or a Snake Armor issue. make your mind up on
probably
that.
Probably Destro.
Could you imagine if they did a Snake Armor issue? It was like following this inanimate object being operated by, like, you know, a troop or something. It'd be hilarious. Yeah, I kind of think, I don't know, we're going to be waiting a while, I think, before we see a real American Hero development, which, yeah, is a little bit of something I hadn't really given any thought to, Brian, so thanks for that. and obviously Paddy doesn't give a shit, so it doesn't matter.
Do not give a
So let's give potatings, Brian and myself, to 250. Brian,
I'm going in with 6 potatoes here. I thought this was a cracker.
That isn't even an option. That isn't even an option, and you've managed to make it an option. I have to go into Photoshop again.
Two people's dinners.
I have to go into Photoshop again and make a 6 potato image for that. So thank you.
Okay,
I'm kidding.
We'll roll it back to 5, but no, you all know it's actually 6.
It's the 6 potato. I'll find a way. I'm going to go for 3.5 again, because it was a really, I still enjoyed the issue, but the ending did knock 2.5 a potato and a half off for me. So I'm going to go for 3.5 potatoes. Just because I love Budo and I want to see Budo and Budo, Budo, Budo. Anyway, let's move on to another IDW-related story about the Transformers. Now, this is kind of a news burst element, but we're going to do it on this comics burst. IDW have made the announcement that the current Transformers continuity will be coming to an end with the Unicron comic in September. They revealed the official news at WonderCon recently, saying that Transformers Unicron is a 6-issue miniseries drawn by Alex Milne and written by John Barber. The series will ship twice monthly beginning in July, and we'll see Optimus Prime rally his fellow Cybertronians in a desperate effort to hold back their all-powerful enemy. An earlier press release from IDW had teased that the series would serve as the epic conclusion to the current Transformers comic book universe, and that was confirmed at the company's panel at WonderCon last weekend. So, we all knew this was the case, but the official word has made it sink in a bit now, guys. What do you think this means for the Transformers as a whole going forward for IDW, and of course, for the combined universe that currently ties them to Joe, Ron, Action Man, Micronauts, Visionaries, and Mask?
Well, I think we can safely say that the combined universe 2016 to 2018 is now dead. Because Transformers was the glue very much that held that together. Like, Visionaries is directly related to Transformers. Mask were built out of Transformers technology.
Yeah. Ron was shining armor, and Wan was like, you know, new, Ron, they had that connection armor, anyway. Yeah.
Tied directly back into Transformers. G.I. Joe, half the G.I. Joe cast were in the Optimus Prime ongoing.
And on Cybertron, yeah.
You had Flint making regular appearances in that.
Only because he's the baby mama daddy.
It's true. But there was other G.I. Joe characters showed up in the Optimus Prime ongoing as well. So I think it's fairly safe to say that it's done, which isn't a surprise. We talked about this on the last podcast we did. More than half the comics they released on the back of this combined universe thing are already cancelled.
Yeah.
Between G.I. Joe and Raw and Micronauts and Mask. So it does feel like that this has been a failed experiment for them.
Yeah.
It never caught on, and the sales weren't there. So it's probably for the best that they're just kind of drawing a line under it. I don't see them ending the Transformers comics as being anything like a failure. I mean, IDW have been publishing Transformers comics for 13 years now.
Yeah.
That is longer than Generation 1 lasted in terms of a toy line. You know, the G1 toy line only lasted like 9 years. The original G1 comic only lasted 7 years, not even. You know, Transformers Generation 2 lasted a year. Beast Wars lasted 3 years. So 13 years for one kind of ongoing storyline that actually, you know, is a more coherent storyline than say the G.I. Joe comics were.
Yeah.
You know, the Transformers, you can see there's a kind of a clear progression as to what happened, despite the fact that there was a couple of soft reboots in there.
That's
something to be proud of.
Like, that's when you think about it, like, Action Force.
What else? Yeah, it's true. We're still talking about that 30 years later. But think of it, there's nothing like, how many TV series have come and gone in that time? Like a TV series, a very successful TV series lasts 7 years.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
You know what I mean? So to do nearly double that and to have comics coming out every month, and IDW has added a lot of stuff to the Transformers kind of mythology that's going to stay around forever, I think.
Yeah.
You know, characters, it's made popular characters out of very secondary characters, and those characters have gone on to do other things, like, you know, Windblade is now come in the new series that's coming, the new Cyberverse series. She's a character in the Transformers Prime cartoon, the Robots in Disguise. They've, you know, brought characters like Chrome Dome back to the spotlight. They've brought the Wreckers back in, you know, the Wreckers, who were an obscure UK-only sub-team, are now a major part of Transformers continuity because of IDW. They gave some really great artists their first work, people like Nick Roach, people like Andrew Griffin, people like, you know, Alex Middleton, although he didn't start with them. You know, he's had a career with them for 13 years now, drawing for them consistently.
Yeah.
A lot of new creators have had their careers started on these comics. So it's leaving behind a really, really strong legacy.
Are they going to be completely revamping the creator teams on the books, do you think?
Well, they haven't said anything about that yet. From what I've heard, what I've seen on people saying it on Twitter, none of that seems to be confirmed yet. Because a lot of the artists and so on are like, well, we don't know what's happening.
Yeah, yeah.
So people that you would expect would be working on those books, if there are more books coming, like they've said, there are new titles coming towards the end of the year. So doing the maths, there's only 20 issues of IDW Transformers comics left in this continuity. That's 6 Unicrons, 6 Optimus Primes, 6 Cup Inches of Lost Light, and then a final Wreckers one-shot.
Yeah.
So that's it. In terms of the comics that are left. And all those books are going to be published twice monthly. So Lost Light goes on to twice monthly issues from next month to wrap everything up by September.
Yeah.
So I imagine they'll give it a break for a couple of months, and then you will probably see a new series kick off in December. And I imagine that will probably tie into the new Transformers toy line, which is coming early next year, which is the War for Cybertron toy line, which brings things back to the start.
I was just contemplating what cons will be happening around, like, late in the year. When does... are there any big
NYCC,
ones?
NYCC is in October.
Ah, so they may reveal something there.
You'll see everything there, I'd say.
Yeah, that's cool. What about you, Brian? How do you feel about the Combined Universe wrapping up? Nothing has been said for sure, but it kind of makes a lot of sense that it will happen, right?
I mean, they've given it a good run. I've really enjoyed it. I've been more focused on, say, the Joe stuff rather than the Transformers tie-ins, obviously with the exception of Transformers versus Visionaries. So, you know, in a way, I'm maybe a little bit sad to see it go, but they don't say this is the end. They're wrapping up the current continuity. So, you know, I'd be hopeful that they're going to come back with they're going to build on the success that they've established so far and come back with something pretty killer later in the year, I hope.
Do you think that way with the Combined Universe? Obviously with Transformers, it's a pretty safe bet. They're going to, you know, they're just going to revamp, reboot and churn a different starting point out and so on and so forth. Like Paddy said, with the, to kind of line up with the toy releases and stuff. But in terms of like the actual Combined Universe, do you honestly think they would do something again with that?
Well, by the sounds of it, they won't be able to resolve everything, say, in the current Transformers and Visionaries miniseries. So that could potentially lead into something else. And so there might be something a little bit more for that. With the Joe, the recent G.I. Joe, Aubrey Citizen's run, that seems to be wrapped up. So there's nothing much happening on that front. ROM is winding down. It looks like they are starting to shut it down, I suppose, is what I'm trying to say.
Yeah.
And so if there is something else on the back of Visionaries,
I would expect a Micronauts comic to tie in with the cartoon series.
Yeah.
That should be starting next year as well.
That's another good point, because you've got a Micronauts movie and you've got a G.I. Joe movie and you've got a ROM movie that's all been kind of like spoken about. So obviously that they would have tie-ins. And like you say, the Micronauts cartoon would be one for a Micronauts comic as well. So there's still life for them to operate.
That cartoon is a full-on reboot. So... Mm. I don't think the comic that would come from that, if there is a tie-in comic to that, it will be a full reboot as well, I would imagine.
Oh, totally,
tie in with that cartoon.
Just to ask the question, with, say, the current Marvel Cinematic Universe, from what I mean, obviously I'm not a big fan of the Marvel comics, not that I've not anything against them, I just never really got into them. Did they explore what's happening in the cinematic universe a few years back previously in the comics? Is that what happened?
No, they're two separate universes, actually. So comic universe is completely separate to the actual MCU, which is like a completely different kind of thing. They just kind of, I suppose, borrow from the source material to kind of create this different visual cinematic experience.
I wonder, would Hasbro kind of take a similar tack here with their cinematic universe that we hope they're going to develop?
Well, yeah, possibly.
Do we hope that?
I mean, I would like to. I mean, obviously, we know that ROM is being written in the process of being written, but we don't know whether that will be something that even goes beyond that. You know, we don't know. Like, Zach Penn's writing it. I love that guy. The fact that his name's Penn, but Zach Penn's writing that. So obviously, there's something there. But is it gonna?
Zach Penn will also tell you that he writes an average of 3 scripts a year.
Exactly.
And maybe one gets filmed.
Exactly.
I didn't get a chance to step in on the Zach Penn burst you did earlier this week. I've met him.
Oh, cool.
Zach Penn. When I was at San Diego in 2007, I attended a panel he was giving about adapting comics to the screen. And I had a chat with him afterwards. Lovely fella. But, you know, he made it quite clear at that panel that he is constantly working. But, like, you may not see a product of his work more than once every 2 years.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Oh,
so
totally, yeah.
He gets hired to write a lot of scripts.
No, I was agreeing with that particular point. Like, initially I was saying, like, you know, will it even get beyond that point? Probably not, but at least we know that something is kind of like, there's an ember there. And it's not based on the fact that the ROM comic sales were really good. It's just, you know, that I think it's one of those brands that Hasbro wants to just revive and wants to actually have, you know, something behind it. And obviously the film is where they're going to make money. They're not going to make money in making a ROM comic book. Just in general, like, comics is not the industry to make money in right now, is it?
Unless the movie flops, of course, in which case they won't make money.
That's true. More of a risk, it's a bigger risk.
One interesting thing I saw actually that came out with that, when we spoke about a month ago about the new deal they had with Paramount, that Hasbro had signed up with Paramount for the next 5 years. A little bit more of the details of that deal have come out.
Oh, yeah.
And it involves Hasbro will be co-financing the pictures with Paramount. So they'll be putting up some actual cash this time.
Oh, right.
To get these movies made. But in exchange for that, they will have more creative control over what the final product is going to be like.
Interesting.
Okay.
So who knows if that is a good thing or a bad thing?
Well, if they haven't had control before and we got Rise of Cobra and so on and so forth, then either it's going to be 1,000 times worse or 1,000 times better.
What a lot of people didn't realise at the time is Larry Hama signed off on the Rise of Cobra script.
Oh, yeah, totally. No, that was well known.
He was hired as a script consultant. Yeah, but it's not something I think people bring up.
He
gave his blessing.
He also said that, like, he did regret what doing that. Like, he was kind of brought in as a consultant but hardly ever used, and like he had to, at one point I think he said he had to put his foot down and say, do not make Snake Eyes talk, because at the one point in the script Snake Eyes was going to say something at the end of the movie. Yeah, and he was like, that is terrible. Not going to happen. And he put his foot down and said, no, that, just do not do that, or you'll ruin the whole thing. And lo and behold.
And yet he did nothing about the lips and the mask.
There's only so much one man can do. I'm just glad. Uh-huh. I'm glad he didn't talk. Although, actually, I wish they had made him say something, because I think that would have made it even more hideous and therefore more fun to watch, because it would have been like, you know, like a Street Fighter style movie.
I do have to say, with getting back to our main topic of discussion, ending in Transformers continuity, I think I am going to jump off when that happens.
Okay.
I think I'm done. I'm too old and too tired to start up with a whole new series.
Go ahead.
So I think
you're 10 years younger than me.
But I just feel like, you know, I've been.
You've invested a lot of effort and
well, I soul. Own every single IDW Transformers comic. The first letter to the editor I got published in something is in an IDW Transformers comic.
Awesome.
I've been reading them since before I started getting hair in my balls. And now,
since you were 27, or is it just me that happened to?
Now I am finished reading them when I don't have any hair in my head. So they're giving me a perfect reason to jump off it. So unless there's a creative team that I think are absolutely going to kill it, I think I'm probably done with them.
I would say give it a like, after it comes out and people are going nuts about it and all that kind of palaver, I'll give it a week before you cave in and buy an issue. But I know how you feel.
I genuinely wonder, because, you know, I do like a lot of what they did. I think the Wrecker series Nick Roach did is really a high water mark for comics, never mind Transformers comics. I think the first couple of years of More Than Meets the Eye are fantastic. Yeah. I loved Simon Furman's Infiltration, Escalation, Spotlight stuff in the early fantastic. Days.
They were great. They were my favorite comics, I think.
Yes, unless I see like a creative team that I can't afford to ignore, I think I am going to ignore it.
Okay.
I do hope that some of the creators they're using at the moment do get to keep working on Transformers. I'd like to see people like Andrew Griffin stay on the art. Mm. They need to give that guy a G.I. Joe series. He is dying to do a G.I. Joe series. He's dying to draw G.I. Joe, and I think he'd do an amazing job. I think they need to keep Kazama.
It's funny how, like, you say that about, you know, one like dying to do a job on it and wanting it because they're like a fan or something. And yet they give it to someone often who doesn't know anything about it or isn't really that, you know, up for doing it. They're just doing it. Like, we've had interviews where people have said, yeah, they offered it to me, so I just, you know, just took it. And it just kind of, I just feel like,
it's paying work, why not?
Give it to someone that really wants to do it, and you get the passion behind it, and you'll see that come through, I think. They don't have to be like a super fan that's collected every toy ever since its inception, but they can certainly have like really strong ideas about certain characters, and they having that knowledge does help without having to go through loads of comics to see, I wonder how like Mainframe acted, or I need to know the, you know, what the personality of this guy was, like, you know, what Flash was like or something. It's just like, just you get people that understand the whole presence of the entire storyline and the characters and stuff, and you'll do a great, you'll get better results, I think, personally. There seems to be a reluctance to hire fans.
Well, because I have a feeling some of it is because they don't want to be accused of writing, of actually releasing fan fiction.
Right,
But on the other side of that, I'd say is they have hired a bunch of fans to do work on the Transformers books.
Nick Roach was a fan.
James Roberts was a fan.
Yeah.
You know, and their books are the better because of it, I think.
Yeah.
Whereas other creators they brought on have not been.
What kind of a job interview process do they have here before they assign these creators to the comics? Like, if it was any other job, you'd sit people down, you'd interview them, you'd want to see, you're gonna hire the people who are the most passionate, the most interested, the most experienced. And they're the ones you're going to give to Joe. Yeah, and he tells you, you really know your stuff. I've got to hire you. Surely they must have some sort of vetting process before they bring some Yahoo on board to make a balls of everything.
I assure you, you know what? Now that he's left, I can tell you this. Chris Ryle basically told me that in order for IDW to hire you, you needed to be either a mate of the editor, or you needed to have a significant enough presence on social media that they couldn't ignore you.
Wow. That's a bit of an exclusive.
Being able to write was very much third on their list of things they were looking for from writers.
By the way, I'm not... I'm going to keep that in, but just make it clear. Paddy Lennon was the person that broke that information. I had nothing to do with it. Yes, I had creative and editing control, but I'm blaming Paddy... 1000%. That's it. That's interesting. Wow.
But like but I'm sorry, but Chris flat out told me that to my face when I met him last August. So, you know, there you go.
Yeah, no, that's fair enough.
So, you know, it didn't matter if I had got the best pitch in the world or I had written one of the best comic books ever. I'm sure that would have helped, but
that's a bigger reveal than the last panel of G.I. Joe versus the $6 Million Man.
But put it this way. Listen.
And that another anonymous transformer that dies.
But doesn't the last year of the G.I. Joe comics make complete sense when you realize they hired the writer because he had 12,000 Twitter followers?
Yeah.
And not because he was a competent writer.
Yeah. Yeah. Like,
that was, you know, that's where we are with it.
I think it's the same in any industry. I mean, it's one of those things where it's not just the comics industry that would say, like, they're not like taking advantage of it, but they're using that platform that if someone has all those fans that they can reach, and obviously this is the way to sell their comics, they're going to do that. You know, that's going to be something that is a very key element of this. So it makes total sense that is a way that's the way forward. Obviously, and it's always been the case that it's who you know. So I don't think it's anything new, but to hear it in that way is always a bit of a shocking, isn't it?
I mean, look, having 12,000 followers didn't really help Aubrey Sitterson because his comic was selling less than 3,000 copies by the end. If the quality's not there, all the social followers in the world aren't going to buy your book.
Yeah, true.
Like, Madeline Visaggio is a good writer, but the fact that she's also very vocal on Twitter probably didn't hurt her.
Yeah.
You know, she has a lot of Twitter followers. She has a lot of people who hate her as well. But, you know, at least she can back it up by being a competent writer.
Yeah, yeah.
Whereas, you know, Aubrey couldn't. As much as, you know, personally, I very much liked him when we spoke to him.
Yeah.
They hired him for a reason and that reason didn't work out.
Yeah.
But, you know, and look, I am not in the slightest bit bitter about what I was told. I amn't. I know that's how the world works. But, I mean, it's the truth. And I respect the guy for telling me the absolute truth.
You can't handle the truth.
You know, all I need to do is hire, you know, is spend a few hundred dollars buying Russian bot followers, and then probably I'll get comics work.
That's what I'm going to do.
And I think on that bombshell, We should... Bombshell is the name of another Transformer, by the way. On that bombshell, we should probably bring an end to this quite fantastic comics burst. That's it for this installment of the Full Force Comics Burst. Thank you to my awesome co-hosts, Paddy and Brian. See you next time, and as always, Full Force. Make sure you get involved with the discussion by liking, sharing, and commenting on these videos. And as always, you can keep up with the show after listening by following on Twitter at The Full Force, liking the Facebook page, facebook.com/TheFullForce. And if you would like to contact the show, you can message us on either of those platforms with feedback, questions, or just a troll. Look out for more of these comic bursts on Podbean, iTunes, Stitcher, our Facebook page, Twitter feed, and YouTube channel from now on. Full Force. And a big shout out to our sponsors, Distant Planet Comics and Collectibles, located at 601 Business Loop 70 West Suite 263, located in the Parkade Center, Columbia, Missouri. You can visit their website at distantplanetcomics.com and on Facebook at facebook.com/distantplanetcomics.